We're here today with Susan Blackwell Ramsey to talk about her new poetry book, A Mind Like This, published by University of Nebraska Press. Winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry, Susan Blackwell Ramsey's A Mind Like This is a work of humor and wit, unexpectedly delightful and full of surprises, as it reflects on the oddness of everyday life, the natural world, literary history, popular culture, and more. Everything is fair game for Ramsey, who finds poetry in love and sickness and life, of course, but also in knitting and unreliable bladders and the peculiar name of Kalamazoo. Neruda makes an appearance, as do Eric Clapton and Brahms, Leonard and Virginia Woolf, and Jimmy Stewart. In fact, one of the poems that was about making love with Jimmy Stewart, and I just love that last line. What is it, Susan?
Gee, that was swell.
Yes. So humor is a big part of your poetry, isn't it?
Yeah. It always feels to me that the consistently tragic are fibbing. Nothing is really without at least black humor, and a lot of the time it's funnier than that. And if you have the luxury of being allowed to find it funny, that's nice too, but I just don't trust the permanently, romantically, tragically.
Tell us about how you started writing. I understand it was at a very early age, and about the acceptance of your first two poems.
I was given a book of best loved poems of the English language when I was seven from an aunt's estate. It still exists, I think, these days. And it was heavy on the poets that everyone used to memorize that no one even reads anymore. James Russell Lowell, John Greenleaf Whittier, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And it was rhymed and it was metrical. And I think that got into the DNA early in the game, as fun. So that as you read the free verse poets, you steal what chops you can from them. But it's more fun to play tennis with the net up. I'm not bright enough to imagine where the net ought to be. So stealing from Frost. And what was the question about the two poems?
Yeah, I read somewhere that when you had your first two poems accepted, you got so excited that you were going up to strangers in the street showing them your letter of acceptance.
Well, my first one, I certainly was going up to George Hebben, the owner of the Athena Bookshop, and showing him that. It was a rant against Charles Bukowski and his effect on otherwise fine young men. Rants are a good form. You can say a lot of things as a poet and still pretend to be a decent human being in your daily life.
Yeah. So with this book, which is closely tied with its publication, that you're a winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize, you also received a prize of $3,000. So do tell, what are you going to do with your $3,000?
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Pay for the daughter, pay for the flowers at my daughter's wedding, I think, so that I don't have to do them myself. It actually works out to be a $2,500 prize and then a $500 $2,500 advance and $500 honorarium. Poets tend not to be money sorts. But it went into cash in a tin box in the bottom of the drawer and being meted out and enjoyed.
Here I figured it was going to go for some knitting project
or
something for your garden.
No.
Because that's a big part of your poetry, too, and who you are as a person, that you're a gardener and that you're also always doing things with your hands. When we were talking earlier, you were knitting a sock, and it fascinated me that you can talk about literature in a very informed way, even as your hands are just doing their own thing. And your knitting and that kind of a thing, that also works into your poetry quite a lot. Is that a similar process?
No, they're opposite processes, which is what's really nice. The knitting impresses people and actually takes very little right brain activity. It's your thumb. Once you've trained your motor memory, then it takes over. Though most knitters get to be good at what kind of knitting will impress people. Lace is really the only knitting that impresses people, and unfortunately it does take some attention. But in both cases, poetry and knitting, and specifically lace, it's form, it's repetition, it's the soothingness of pattern. as opposed to the boringness of routine, and you just have to decide what your level is of jazzing it up.
Yeah, one of your poems about lace, I like that it had something in there. I can't recall the line exactly right now, but about absence. And I thought that's like music with a pause, and poetry too, isn't it? About what you leave out,
maybe? It's about what you leave out. Mm-hmm. That's where editing and critique groups are useful things, because you, especially just reading someone else's, you go, oh, you don't have to say A, B, C, D. You can go A, G, and mm-hmm. it works. Neruda is one of the people we love for that, those leaping South American poets. You go, oh, yeah. I don't have to be logical. What a relief.
A big part of your process is working with critique groups and workshops, and there's some pretty big local and otherwise known names in your groups that you participate in. Talk to us about how important that is to your work, how much of a process that has been in putting this work together.
It would be really hard for me to write well without these readers. If only because you're, by being in a critique group of people that you trust, you're renting an audience. So you can be free to write what amuses you, what pleases you, what seems like it might be. You don't have to pre-edit as badly. You can include everything, you can clean it up some, and you can take it to people who you, whose intelligence and skills you trust, to look at it and say, no. And your little heart may break, but it's only your literary heart that's breaking. And sometimes you believe them and sometimes you don't. And sometimes you believe them on a long fuse, and 6 weeks later you go, oh, well, all right. But to be a consistently good writer and self-editor without these people would take a lot more intelligence and skill than I've managed, and strength than I've managed to accumulate.
So is it a myth that we always talk about writers, that writing is a very isolating type of art?
No, it's all back and forth. It's that regular pattern of absences things. You have to, it's walking aboard, it's Anne of Green Gables walking the ridgepole. You have to try it out on people. You have to talk only to yourself. You have to say the things that are most true for you and trust that they'll be true for everybody else, even if they're made up entirely of inconsequential, frivolous, trivial, peripheral things, which is what mine are.
Hmm. Now, Kalamazoo has been listening to you read at readings. I know I've been at a lot of them, and I've often approached you at the end, or at least had the thought in my mind, Susan, get out a book already. And so your name is already very well known. What took so long? Why were you teasing us all this time?
Yeah, it's because I've been saving it, and because nobody picked my book to publish. And that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. It's been going out there. We were talking earlier, and I promise you, I am not really clear on what's in this book, not because I'm being snotty about it, but because every year it comes back, and every year over the summer you change it, and every fall you send it out again. And
this, you have a good read coming then.
I pity the people in the audience who have been hearing the same poems all these years, and yet I have a soft spot in my heart for the booksellers, because for decades I would represent Athena at readings in town, and the worst thing a bookseller can hear is a poet who says, well, I'm not going to read anything from my published works tonight, because they're in love with the new stuff, and they just know it's going to drive you to buying all of their back copies that you spent a fortune ordering in and will be spending a fortune sending back, because people will only want to buy what they just heard. And yet you're right, people have been hearing me read these poems a long time in this town. And there are two readings, one at the Portage Library on September 12th, and one at the Kalamazoo Library, thanks to Friends of Poetry, on November 5th, and they'd better be substantially different, and yet how many good poems does any one person have? It's going to be exciting to see how I balance that ridgepole.
And your books, I assume, will be available and you'll sign them?
Different independent booksellers in Kalamazoo will be selling it, each of them, bless their heart. And I think all of the independent booksellers have it now, too. Triple bless their hearts.
Mm. Now, in your dedication of the book, you wrote something in there that you're the only person in the world who reads poetry but doesn't write it. Is that to your husband?
No, my husband. My husband is the only person in the world who reads poetry and doesn't
write it. Yeah, the dedication to him. Now, is that truly your belief? That only poets read poetry?
I haven't seen much to contradict it. I think that most people who read poetry and enjoy it write it, which isn't maybe saying the same thing.
Hmm.
But I think poetry is inviting in ways that the grand house of fiction might daunt people, though even then a lot of people are supposed to have a novel in that bottom drawer. Mm-hmm. But I think mostly if people enjoy poetry, they take a stab at it, whether they admit it or not.
Well, you're also a teacher. I assume you've given it some thought. You know, poetry is something that a lot of people, the general public, seem to think of as inaccessible or is too difficult, too dense somehow. What can we do to wake people up to poetry?
Poetry is a big house. There are a lot of different wings to it. And the people in the different wings might not even admit that the other wings are really poetry. People used to love poetry. People used to, even though they were forced to memorize it in school and recite it, poetry got adventurous and exciting and experimental, and not everyone will like every experiment. And I think that Billy Collins has a wonderful poem, Introduction to Poetry, where he talks about wanting his students to read the poem as if they were water skiing across its surface and the poet were waving to them from shore, or as if they were a mouse dropped into a maze and sniffing it out, but all they want to do is tie poetry to a chair and beat it with a rubber hose to ask it what it means. And I think the problem mostly is having to teach poetry when you don't feel really secure about it yourself, and therefore asking people for the themes. And I think that ruins a lot of people for realizing that it's actually fun. So it's fun when poetry gets in the news for Billy Collins having a $6 million contract, or Amiri Baraka being fired as Poet Laureate of New Jersey, because it suggests that it could be doing something other than being on a test.
Mm. I think probably free verse has opened that up a little bit more, maybe to the writers of poetry. But you've also said forms are skeletons, not corsets, which I think is a wonderful line. And in your poetry, there's a lot of form in there and a lot of variation of form.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've been gratified that my students at the KIA seem to agree in the sense that they write really good poetry in form. Forms, each form tends to correspond to a certain emotional states, so that if you're feeling obsessive or in love, any of the things that make you return to the same idea, there are forms to represent that. The pantoum, where you repeat entire lines. Villanelles, where lines go away and come back again and yet rhyme with the things that have appeared in between. Sonnets, where Frost said, if you feel like saying something for 8 lines and taking it back for 6, you might have a sonnet on your hand. So the forms came into existence because they help channel thoughts. In my case, I'm a really linear thinker, left, right, left, right. And forms are useful for me because they nudge you. You have to do this. You can't just say what you were going to say, which often when you finish saying that is where the poem ought to start. And forms can nudge you into saying things that you mean but didn't realize that you thought until the form required you to do some gymnastics. And they're fun. They're the best fun there is.
Yeah. So what makes a great poem? And maybe your answer is different if I say what makes a great poem for you and what makes a great poem, period, in general. But do you know when you've written a poem, yes, this is it, I'm done, I'm finished? Can you How's that walking away process work for you?
Somebody asked in a Tracy Brimmel workshop this weekend, an artist, a visual artist who was just coming to writing and was smart enough to take a revision workshop early on, and said, so the rest of you have done this more. How do you know when a poem is done? And everyone there had quotations from other poets about how Yeats famously said, when a poem is done, you can tell because it clicks shut like a box. And everybody rolls their eyes and smacks their foreheads and says, yeah, well, that's Yeats. You know, other people are quoting the people who said it's never done, it's abandoned. The visual artist, when they turned it around and said, how do you know when a visual piece is done? And she said, yes. We said, how? Well, when I can't either add a mark or take a mark away without making it worse. Well, I suppose, but...
So how do you know, Susan?
I don't. You try it out on people, you change it. E.B. White supposedly wrote 8 drafts of Charlotte's Web, and in the first 3, Fern wasn't even there.
Oh.
And there's a letter where he'd finished the 8th draft and was pretty satisfied, but said he was going to put it in a bottom drawer and let the body heat go out of it. And that can work both ways. If you are willing to just let some time pass and get excited about other things and then go back, it can work both ways. You can both find out, whoops, not only has the body heat gone out of it, but it's non-resuscitatable. Or you can find, oh, that was better than I thought it was. Some people are such perfectionists that they go on improving a poem after it's been published. And one of the exciting things that Tracy Brimhall, who is currently in town and so well worth reading, did was to show us 2 poems by Marie Howe, 2 poems, 1 poem by Marie Howe in 2 forms, 1 poem by Sharon Olds in 2 forms, both of which you had probably read in one form or the other, and you were able to compare how it was published and how it appeared in the anthology later. And in both cases, they'd made it worse.
Oh, interesting.
So pretty indisputably. So it's useful to...
know when to walk away.
and I don't think anybody ever does. But yeah, don't over-improve it.
So when you work on a poem, and I'm sure this varies poem to poem, there's one in here that's just a few lines long, but in general, what's your process? How do you get that idea? How long does it take? Do you revise over years, and you have to take it to your work group several times?
I could just answer yes to all of those.
Okay.
There's a poem in here that took 2 years because it's a sestina, where 6 words repeat in a particular pattern over and over, and it's about jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty happy with it, and I sent it out, and it came back, and I sent it out, and it came back. And the next year, a year had passed, and I once again was listening to Garrison Keillor's annual joke show, and there was a new joke that gave me a better ending for it. So in that case, a year's worth really helped.
Okay. Why is poetry important?
Because it doesn't matter. It's people deplore poetry and how it's ignored in this country. But when I did my MFA at Notre Dame, I was so lucky in being there at the same time as the Irish poet Nuala McGonnell, who writes only in Irish and who teaches a class on modern Irish language poetry, which means basically since 1916. So she had either all of the people in the class, except for one who'd been murdered for the 1916 uprising, she had either been a student of, a colleague of, or a teacher of everybody in the course. And she was vehement in saying that in Ireland, where people do pay attention to poetry, writing poetry is like entering a bath of piranhas, and writing Irish language poetry is like entering a sink of piranhas, because everyone remembers what you did 10 years ago and what you said and what your assertions were and how you're contradicting yourself now. So it's lovely to have nothing much writing on it so that you can just get all the pleasure out of it. It matters because it's pleasurable. I'm a hedonist. I'm a lazy hedonist. So poetry that it's nice that we have such wonderful teachers in this town, because I might miss some really good poetry if I were just left to my lazy hedonistic self. But Diane Seuss at Kay College, Conrad Hilberry at Kay College will teach classes for adults. And I can specifically remember Con teaching Heather McHugh and Di teaching Mary Shebist, and my reading the books in advance and going, yeah, well, too deep for me. And then being taken line by line through them and going, oh my God, this is the greatest thing that ever happened. Mm. And I wouldn't get it otherwise.
Tell us a little bit more about the title, A Mind Like This, because I've heard you say things like, I have a lint roller for a brain, or to compare your mind to a junk drawer, where I think more it's like a treasure chest, Susan. But tell us a little bit more about that.
Tastes vary. I have a mind that only hangs on to the peripheral. I retain everything as long as it's of no earthly use whatsoever. Don't ask me about tax codes or, and you can suffer with it. My nearest and dearest suffer from it. Or you can decide you just have to do that as hard as ever you can and hope that it works out for people.
And maybe you can read your title poem from the book.
That it probably sums it up. A mind like this is like looking through that drawer for scotch tape and coming up instead with the instructions for the digital watch you threw away 3 years ago, a maze made of cheap pink plastic and three ball bearings, the scissors you warned them were only for fabric, a roll of the paper tape they gave you to close your eye for sleep that spring you had Bell's palsy, and half a pack of basil seeds. It's missing the big play because you're busy watching the lovers quarrel two rows down. Look up at as the crowd surges to its feet around you. Touchdown! It's knowing they used the sets from King Kong as tinder for the burning of Atlanta while being uncertain of your best friend's birthday. Forgetting the name of your fifth niece but knowing Carlo was Emily Dickinson's dog. When a mind like this hears that Burley Grimes was the last pitcher to throw a legal spitball in 43, you'd think it had spotted a sapphire in the gravel. It's saving pocket lint and bottle caps while bread and diamonds thunder down the chute. It's a theater where pleasure and frustration are mutual understudies, a computer that refuses to interface 7/15 of the time. It's dutifully viewing the list of cathedral features in Strasbourg, then watching the memories dragged like sand from a beach besieged by wave after wave of years until only a bit of carved stone remains, a fragment small enough to lodge in a human heart. Of course you didn't take a photograph. And of course sensible friends return with cameras full of statues and windows and 20-foot clocks, asking vaguely, "What was that again?" Be comforted. This ridiculous mind will save your incised memory of the 10th pulpit step, preserving for you how some particular hand carved under a stone leaf, small in all that grandeur, his round skulled puppy sleeping, chin on paws.
Thank you. We who love poetry are grateful for a mind like yours, Susan. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. Kalamazoo decides she likes her name. It's true, she used to cringe when people laughed. She'd wish she had a normal name, like Springfield. But the way Glenn Miller savored her name, letter by letter, helped. It really did. She started to feel special, briefly drew those O's as double hearts, then razor-trimmed it to an edgy zoo. Kalamazoo. She says it slowly, rolls it on her tongue, over the pebbles in feeder creeks, the A's flat as Midwestern prairies, the Z buzzing in wild lupins, that single L bobbing back and forth between the A's, meadowlark on a grass stem, the final oo waist deep in that long grass, glad at having tricked your lips into a kiss.